Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, welcome back to In the Pink with me, Natalie Pinkham. Now, we know many of you are Formula One fans. We also know that this is a very long, dark, cold winter. But we're here to help. We're here to help you with your Formula One withdrawal symptoms. And we've done that by pulling together the F1 In the Pink podcast best bits that will no doubt take you through to Australia and beyond when the 2020 season starts again. So, we've cast our mind back through all the podcasts that we've done and right back to the very beginning, in fact. So it feels like the best place to start for the best bits is with our very first podcast, Mr. Daniel Ricciardo. Here he is, DR and his best bits.
Happiness. What is your definition of it? How do you think we can strive towards it? Because I have to say, the general consensus on you is you are the happiest man in the paddock. You seem to have this ability when the visor goes down to be a ruthless racer. And I think that's where the respect comes from. You don't fool around in the car, but as soon as you're out of it. I have never had a bad interview with you, and I talked to all the other reporters and presenters in the pit lane. And even if you've had a crap weekend, you put a smile on. And you certainly don't project any negativity onto whoever you're talking to. You are one of life's radiators rather than drains.
Do you have some tissues?
That's beautiful. But it's true, though. It is true. You know, and it's important to surround yourself by radiators in life. I remember talking to a guy that I work with at our charity who said, the most important thing is surround yourself by life's radiators, not drains, and then you will be productive.
Yes. Yeah, you don't want people droming you out and call them sappuccinos.
There you go.
Sap the life and energy out of you. So, I think happiness is the key to so many things. And for me, I've noticed happiness has been the key to success. You know, like, you know, in a brief example, I know that from a racing point of view, if I'm happy, if I'm having a good weekend and I've just got kind of a spring in my step, and I'm putting the helmet on with a smile, I'm normally having a great race or a great session, or, you know, like, so I think happiness is a form of kind of freedom as well. And, you know, all I would kind of say is that I kind of get a bit upset when people get kind of just comfortable, because I just think there's a lot more to life than being comfortable. People kind of settle for maybe a certain job or a certain lifestyle, and it's fine, but I think it could be better, you know. And I think, do something that makes you happy. Don't just do a job because a lot of people are like, oh, but I'll work hard now and then I'll, you know, when in 20 years' time I'll be able to buy the front door of my house that I always wanted. And I think you can have both. I really do. And there's been many examples over time of people who have done great things, but just find what makes you happy. Be surrounded by good people, happy people, and it's not that hard. It really isn't. So, yeah, if you're not happy with your current situation, do something about it.
Okay, next up on In the Pink Best Bits from Formula One is another young racer who's come through indescribable horror to develop an incredible racing career and actually, surprisingly, a really fabulous broadcasting one. I say surprisingly, because who knew that he would be so very good on camera? It's just another string to his bow. I am, of course, talking about Billy Munger. And I spoke to him for the first time on this podcast a year after his accident. And obviously much has happened since then, but I think this gives a really interesting insight into what he's been through and where he's going. So here he is, Billy Munger, and his best bits of the In The Pink podcast. Let's talk about the accident, because we are... It's not even a year yet, is it?
No, not a year, mate. I think it's 2 more weeks into a year. It's gone so quick.
Yeah, it really has. I mean, I remember meeting you at Mike Tyndall's golf day, and you just had the accident, and your spirits were remarkable. But how were you feeling inside? I mean, just cast your mind back before the accident and then enduring, and just describe it to us. Just tell us, and anyone who out there who doesn't know, what actually happened.
So obviously it was, like you say, nearly a year ago now, and... It was the second round of the F4 British Championship, which we were doing quite well in at the time. It was sort of, I think we had 2 or 3 podiums in the first 4 or 5 races, so it was kind of, we were right up the sharp end, and the aim was always to fight for the title, and then obviously had the accident in that sixth race of the year, I think it was, at Donington. Just a stationary car just spun off, and my view was kind of blocked by 2 other cars that I was racing with. And as they pulled out the way last minute, it was kind of, this car was just suddenly all I could see. So it was one of those sort of accidents where it's no one's fault, but it's just one of those things that can happen sometimes. Mm. But it was, obviously it was a tough time at that point for everyone involved, like my family and friends and stuff.
Yeah. So what do you actually remember of it? Or have you been able to sort of block a lot of the pain out?
I wasn't even in pain at the time. I think I was awake for the first 40 minutes after my accident, and then they put me into an induced coma. But in terms of being in pain, obviously the medics were really good at getting to me quite quick. And at the time, like I said, I felt fine. So I told them to go look at the other driver, because I felt fine, but I could hear him in pain. So I thought, I'd send them over there. And it wasn't until sort of 5 minutes afterwards where sort of the adrenaline kind of goes away, and you kind of just sat there, and then they started to feel a little bit more, a bit more in pain from the accident, and I realised that my injuries were worse than what I thought when I was just sat in the car waiting for the medics to kind of finish dealing with the other driver.
So what did you think at the time on the scene? How bad did you think it was?
I know it was quite bad, because just purely off people's faces. I mean, it was a weird feeling being sat in the car, not being able to get out because of how bad the crash was. But just looking around at sort of the doctors' faces and everything, you could see not panic spreading in, but they knew how serious it was quite early on. Mm. So I guess it was kind of a helpless feeling at that point, because you can't do anything. You've just got to rely on what everyone else is going to do for you. Luckily they did a good job and I'm still here.
Absolutely. Now, in that 40 minutes that you just talked of, your sister was with you, wasn't she? Tell us what you remember of the conversation that you had with Bonnie.
Yeah, she was still with me by the side of the car. Obviously, when the doctors went out on track, they asked if any of the family wanted to come out. And at that point, my mum was sort of, she was a bit fragile, so Dad was looking after her, and Bonnie said that she'd go. And then she was kind of perched by the side of my car for, like you say, the first 40 minutes that I could remember before they put me to sleep. So she was kind of there the whole time. I can't really remember what she was saying to me. I think she was just more being there for support, kind of. It was good to have someone, a familiar face by your side when something like that's happening.
Because you're close in age, aren't you? What, like 14, 15 months apart?
Yeah.
She's younger.
Yeah, 14 months, she's younger than me.
So, you know, you're almost twins in a way. My kids are actually the same age gap. And already they kind of squabble and love each other to a ridiculous extent. It's either one or the other. Is it the same with Bonnie?
Yeah, it's exactly the same. I mean, when we were younger, we always used to argue with each other. But now we've got a bit older and stuff, it's a bit of both, really. We're either arguing with each other or we're really close.
So in a way, I bet that must have helped a massive amount, having her there when you needed her most. I mean, it must have been tough for her. Have you talked about it afterwards?
No, it's not something that we've really talked about. She's a fiery redhead, my little sister, so she can look after herself. She's normally the one trying to look after me. So, it's not really been something that that we've had to talk about. It was good in that moment to kind of, to have her by my side, even though, we weren't arguing at the time, luckily enough.
and then they put you into this induced coma that then lasted for 3 days. What do you remember of waking up and the realisation that actually you had lost both legs?
It was obviously a bit of a surreal moment. Like I said, the only thing that helped me, I think, in that situation was the fact that I knew it was going to be fairly serious beforehand, before they put me to sleep. I think it would have been tougher for me to think everything was going to be okay and then wake up and then them tell me such devastating news. But, it definitely helped for them to kind of ease me into it, I guess you could say. And then having family and friends around when I kind of realised the injuries, that was obviously helpful as well. So, no, it was kind of... Although it's such a shocking thing to find out, there was a few things that happened in the build-up to it that I think, for me, helped me to move on with it a bit quicker.
And how did you move on? Like, I mean, again, I saw you just weeks later and I couldn't believe that you were up and about and in interacting with people and not feeling sorry for yourself in any way. But what was going on inside?
It's difficult to say, really. Obviously, I didn't really have a chance to sit in hospital in the dark and kind of get myself down about it, just because I had so many bubbly kind of positive people around me. Like, my family were there, some of my friends from school and from racing, all the members of the team, they were always coming to the hospital. I don't think I had a day in hospital where I didn't have more people than I was meant to have in my room with me, which was obviously really helpful, because it just feels normal when you've got people around you that you know. If I was sat in hospital and I didn't have anyone around me that I really knew, then I might have felt a bit different. But no, it definitely helps out a lot.
And the motorsport community really did rally, didn't it? I mean, I remember this just outpouring of support for you, firstly on social media and then in actual terms, people fundraising. The crowdfunding was just immense. Just tell us about that and that kind of boost that it gave you.
Yeah, it was crazy. I mean, obviously, when I had my accident, they put me in an induced coma, and I can't remember anything from that Sunday evening when it happened to, I think I woke up the middle of Wednesday. So it was sort of 3 days after the accident that I was kind of, although I'd been awake with all the drugs I was in, that I had in my system, I wasn't really in the room at the time, even though I was awake. So that was sort of the first sort of thing I could remember. And obviously at that point, the Just Forgiven page had already gone up and was live. So it was kind of, I woke up and people were showing me, look at all this support you're getting. And it was kind of, it was there from the earliest point I remember, the support was there. So it was, a bit surreal, really. But, like I say, I didn't even know anything was going on. I was, daydreaming, I guess you could say. And then, I woke up and to all this support, and it was a bit overwhelming. But it was, a pretty cool feeling to have from early days anyway.
How do you think your mum and dad have coped?
I think at the time they were putting on strong faces when I was in hospital. The doctors were telling them behind closed doors. My mum was telling me that they said that you've got to be strong, because obviously, however their attitude was towards it rubs off on how I'm going to feel about it. They did an awesome job early on of being strong and being able to cope with what had happened. But I think, it was obviously a tough time for them. They didn't. I think it probably affected my dad early on more than it affected my mum, just because he was the one who got me into racing. So I think at some stage he probably felt a bit guilty for what had happened to me. I just told him that it was something that, although he couldn't force me to do it, although he wanted me to do it from a young age, it was something that I wanted to do myself. Otherwise, I wouldn't have done it. So I think that kind of helped him get over things. And then obviously my mum, with everything going on, trying to be the strong one and hold everyone together. It was tough on her as well, and I think she's taken a bit longer to get come to terms with it, just because early on she probably blocked it out more than the rest of us did. But no, I think we're getting there, and like I say, we're quite strong as a unit. So I think that's how everyone's helping each other out.
And do you think it has brought you closer together?
Yeah, I think so. I'd agree with that. Obviously, there's been times where it gets someone down and there's an argument, and it's kind of it is quite a testing time for everyone. But I think in general we are closer together than we were before.
So do you talk about it a lot as a family?
Not really. Not unless it's brought up. I mean, it's kind of some of us. I don't mind talking about it as much as my mum does, just because people have asked me questions about it quite regularly since it's happened. So it's kind of something that I've just been made aware of and talked about a fair bit. Well, my mum kind of, like I say, blocks it out a bit more. So when it does come up, she probably is more affected by it than I am.
Mm. That's really interesting, because I read something about PTSD, and that if you have a big trauma, that you just need to keep talking until it no longer feels scary to talk about. The more you bury it, then the minute something does come up, then it acts as a catalyst to like open the floodgates, and you start crying and you get very emotional again. And so I guess maybe talking about it has been your therapy in some way.
Yeah, I probably think so. I mean, like, I was sort of, every day I had people in the hospital, and even if we weren't talking about that, we were talking about racing-related things. So it's kind of, I think the whole having people around me that were talking about things to do with racing and obviously what happened to me quite early on, I think that really helped me to kind of just come to terms with it. And like you say, I wasn't, after a few days, I wasn't really scared of what had happened anymore. Obviously, it lasts longer than a few days. It's not that simple, but the majority of what had happened and the overwhelming feeling I had was kind of gone quite soon.
Another best bit, another Aussie. It's Mark Webber, and he is an Australian that we've all taken to our hearts, that we kind of claim as our own, really, don't we? He is lovely company, and I really enjoyed talking to him. So it was lovely listening back to his podcast and picking out our favourite moments. Here he is. It always feels as if England has taken you to our hearts in the same way that you have to yours. Mm. Is that how it feels to you?
Totally. Absolutely. I think, I moved here in 96, and I did all my junior racing here. I was in Hainaut in Essex for 6 months, about 8 months, which was from Australia. That's in a box room where I could hardly get myself straight in. But it was just like, and I was going to a gym down the road there, not a clue what I was doing. Talk about just like wandering around here going, I am just so no one here in this huge, population, which it is, the UK. I mean, London is like, my God, I'm a country kid from Australia.
You were like Crocodile Dundee, basically, weren't you?
I was bloody Crocodile Dundee. I wasn't carrying a knife. I still don't now. But, amazing how I did move around a little bit in the UK. And I just, it's funny because my dad loved English comedy. So Open All Hours and the Two Ronnie, all that stuff. So I think that's sort of, he injected some of that into me, just the respect of how, what he said, mate, I bloody love the Poms, mate. I love the Poms. They're so bloody funny. Rah, rah. So,
I mean, there's one thing liking the humour and the culture. There's another thing living in a box room in Hainaut Park, like wondering, who am I? Where am I? I mean, you really were a fish out of water, weren't you? And just tell us how that process happened. I mean, how did you end up there?
I was racing in Australia in the sort of 94, 95. And what was I then? Sort of 17, 18. And then a bit of a scholarship, I suppose, to come to the UK. It was to be the best racing driver in the world. You've got to come to Europe or England. At that point in your career, at that age group, it's like tennis. If you want to be, in the tennis academies, whether it's clay in Spain or whether it's in Florida or where the weather's good for the tennis, youngsters need to be exposed to that type of scene. And the scene in Europe and the UK, that's the hotbed of talent back then. So I needed to immerse myself in that environment. So I'd met Anne, my now wife, when I was about 17. And she was working in Australia at the time. And she said that you've got to give the UK a go. And actually, I'll go back as well. And let's give it a go. So yeah, we're staying at Anne's mum's house actually, the first, because we didn't have a house obviously, so we stayed.
And let's just kind of cast your mind back a bit more to that childhood that you're talking about. And what are you, the sort of standout memories for you from it? Was it a happy time? Was it full of laughter? As you say, your dad was just giggling nonstop to English humour. But you've always been an outdoorsy kind of person. Is that what it was all about?
I think I really reflect. So, I mean, so many positives on my childhood. I think because I grew up in a rural area. So sport, community sport was massive. So my mum was huge on having a go and very little excuses. So mum would take me to swimming club and was like, "Mum, I don't want to swim all strokes." "Well, you are swimming all strokes. Mum, the water's freezing." "I know it's freezing, Mum, but you're going to get in there and you're going to do it." I'd have my little speedos on, you know, it wasn't all, it was just freezing. And I'm just in, just, "Mum, Wednesday night swimming club in Queanbeyan, like this is, like, if people know about where this place is and just, you know, it's just." But it was amazing how the families got together, all my buddies, we'd ride BMX bikes, we do. And I only look back now and sort of think just how simple, but yet how straightforward. And I went home to a brilliantly, like, mum was a bit of a disciplinarian, but, and dad was a bit loose with me in a good way. So he gave me a bit of the elastic band to stretch that relationship with mum. But in terms of my wild streak, which he'd certainly put fuel on to give me the chances to learn, and I'd already injured myself. I mean, motorbikes, I was, you know, on the dirt bikes on the farm or stuff. And he'd love seeing that because he was jovial at heart himself.
It sounds like you did have a lot of strong influence and advice growing up. But is there any advice you'd give to your younger self now, looking back?
I think, you know, continuing, you know, when you believe that you're working hard, which I believed, I believe I really did work hard. I would like to have worked a bit more on the mental side of the sport. I think physically I was definitely in one of the best shapes I could be in my life. I didn't leave anything on the table there in terms of my preparation on that. Probably seek out a bit more just to handle just a bit of distraction control and just a bit of handling that last, because, I mean, pressure and, you know, delivering and your breaking points is all generally around, you know, just all those distractions and what are those things that there's always something that will break someone, you know, like what is that final thing that's going to start to break you down? And is it with your own performance? Is it with, you know, I mean, in our sport, as we know, so a lot of the listeners, you know, will know, but it's such a technical sport. There's so many things which we have to contribute towards our performance on an engineering side that, we've got 500 people at the factory and we're trying to... So there's so many things that you learn along the way that you're like, wow, if I had a bloody known that earlier, or you've got columns of energy to say, I actually probably overcooked that column in terms of the energy I put into it, but if I bloody just shifted a couple of percent over to that one for myself, in terms of how I strip that down, and probably... even just things like probably just a bit more rest as well. Just more rest, more sleep, you know, plan better. I always wanted to leave on, you know, after races. I want to get the first flight out there and get out of there. Well, Mark, actually, you know, I was busting to get back to your own bed, but it's like sometimes, like, mate, you just chill, you know, let's get... So I think I would have liked to have somehow brought a bit less stress into my profession somehow.
So do you think you could have enjoyed it a bit more?
Yes, I think... that could have been, yeah, something which I should have... It was quite interesting. Like, my third last race after Korea, 13 drivers, we all got on a plane together. We flew in a private jet from Korea to Narita, and we started to get... We just had a few drinks on the plane, and then we went out in Tokyo on the Sunday night.
I remember this.
After the Korea.
I secretly wanted to be there, obviously.
Yeah, you would have done well there, Pinky. Yeah. But obviously on that Sunday night...
You had a massive session.
Was massive. Absolutely huge. We had 13 drivers. Monday goes by, and then Tuesday, I had some other friends arrive, and we all were talking about how amazing Sunday night was. I said, yeah, well, it sounds amazing, but, you know, if you're not there, I said, I'll tell you what, we'll go again Tuesday night. So we went back to the Tuesday night.
To the same place.
Same place.
Amazing.
Massive. Massive night again. I qualified on pole on Saturday. Only qualified on pole. So to answer your question, like, obviously, I was not going to be drinking like that, you know, and I rarely drank when I was racing. So, you know, to your point, what could I have done different? So could I just release the pressure valve, a sniff, not drinking at all? In terms of, you know, I don't need to do that, but in terms of just how intense I was and how individual and how sort of driven I was and probably how selfish, but if I just tried to enjoy it a bit and not let that, you know, the professional, the all-encompassing sort of, you know, the whole global effect of it sort of pull me down a bit. I think that is definitely a component I could have but I saw that as showing other people, especially my employee, like if they found out, I mean, which they would, I mean, they knew it was my last two or three races, so Martin, it was a bit of a thank you for all the drivers, he's on his way anyway, but I was just very old school on that.
Right, next up on the Formula One Best Bits, it's a young lady who surprised many of you. Lots of you wrote and got in touch on social media to say how pleasantly surprised you were by Tamara Eccleston. I think many of us have preconceived ideas about her being a billionaire's daughter, born with a silver spoon, but actually she spoke candidly and very entertainingly about being Bernie's daughter and what life has been like for them all. And she was great company, so here she is, Tamara Eccleston, her best bits. So how soon were you aware how smart your dad is in terms of the way he approaches business and what he was doing specifically with Formula One? Because really, it's difficult to imagine the sport would ever have got to the stage it has now without your dad. I mean, it simply wouldn't have happened. It was a minority sport. It is now a global one, and he's taken it to corners of the earth that you never would expect Formula One to be adopted and loved in the way that it is. I mean, I'm thinking of places like Azerbaijan. I mean, who would ever have thought F1 would have gone there? But how aware were you of all of this process?
So as a child, I think that you just think that everyone's parents are the same as your parents, and you kind of don't really think that you're different in any way or that your dad's different. I did know that he was really good at maths and adding up because he was always helping me with my homework. And whenever I'd be like, how much is, so, you know, 500,000 divided by 36, whatever, and he would come up with the answers so quickly, and I was like, oh my God, he's like a math genius.
I thought you were going to ask me the answer then, but thank God
no,
you didn't.
No. Okay. Okay, so my dad was always really, like, really quick with numbers. So I was like, oh, my dad's, like, really, really smart. But I never thought of it in terms of business until I was a lot older.
Okay.
And then, obviously, the older I got, I became more aware of what he did and that he had created. You know, when I went to F1, I just thought, like, this is amazing. My dad has created this. And I just always felt super proud every time I, like, walked into the paddock. And I was like, this is amazing to have. You look at the pictures of what the sport was like when he was much younger and then how it's changed and grown and developed. And I just thought it was, like, really awesome that he made, yeah, he made F1 what it is today, but also he did it not for the money. He did it truly because he loved it and that's what he believed in and he was passionate about. Because at a certain point, he could have retired and gone to Florida and played golf, but that was just never my dad.
I mean, that's the thing. I always feel with him that it's almost a game, that every kind of interaction he has with somebody, and I don't mean that in a frivolous sense, I mean it that he wants to outsmart and he wants to outmaneuver. Again, not necessarily solely competitive, but because it's interesting and it keeps him motivated and stimulated and everything else. So it's not something he could ever really walk away from. I mean, even now, it feels very strange not having him in the paddock.
I know, it is. It's really strange for me. But the thing is that I think that being the way he is, like you say, always being one step ahead and always thinking ahead and everything is kind of like a game. I think it's kept him so young. I mean, he's just turned 88 and it's literally not like talking to an 88-year-old. Right. He's so fit. He's so sharp. He's just, yeah, I think that doing something that he cares about and that he's loved and that he's so passionate about has kept him really, really young.
There's so many anecdotes that fly around about him, and I'm sure some of them are urban myths, but I love a few. One of them was that, and it's a really small example of what we've been talking about, that Pirelli wanted to do cowboy hats on the podium instead of baseball caps.
Okay.
And it's a really quirky little marketing idea, but Bernie, you know, other people would have gone, yeah, fine, do it. He goes, yeah, you can do that, but it will cost X, Y, Z to do it.
Yeah.
And why not put a price on it? Because then, when Lewis then won the race, he was on the front of every single paper around the world wearing a Pirelli cowboy hat. So Bernie knew the gain that Pirelli would get from this, because it was a very smart move, but he wasn't about to just let it slip through. He wasn't going to give it away, exactly. And that is what he's based the whole empire on, isn't it?
I think that him coming from such humble beginnings and having to work from such an early age, and he tells me about the fact that he used to sell like cakes on the school playground, and I was like, well, did you ever eat the cakes? And he was like, no, why would I want to eat my profit? And I'm like, oh, I would have eaten the cake. But yeah, I think that because he's had to fight and struggle and just work so hard, he knows like the value of absolutely everything. And rightly so, why should he give it away? He's built this empire. So when someone says, should we do this way, for him to put a price on that, I guess is like his natural train of thought, because that's how he is where he is. Whereas some people wouldn't necessarily think there's a value attached to changing a baseball cap to a cowboy hat. But my dad just thinks outside the box and does see things for what they really are.
So would you describe him as a frugal person? Or do you think he's a... Yeah, okay.
He totally doesn't agree with how I live my life.
Really?
Yeah, no, he's very down to earth and very humble, and he doesn't take pleasure in shopping, for instance. Things like that don't make him happy.
So what does make him happy? Doing deals?
Doing deals, saving pennies, like... buying something that's on sale, getting a great deal on something, that makes him truly happy.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so do you get your kind of more extravagant side from your mum?
I don't know who I get it from. Listen, I've married someone that's actually quite like my dad in that sense. So I've reined things in the sense that Jay's like, okay, shop around, get a quote. Don't just like pay the first person that tells you it's this much. So actually, like, both the men in my life are actually quite similar in that way. And that's quite good for me, because I'm like, I guess... Yeah, it's good to have someone that looks out for you. So Jay is like, so many people want to rip you off. They know that you like have money. So actually, don't be silly. Let's take our time. Let's shop around, etc. And it's really sweet that Jay takes care of me in that sense. And it's kind of funny because I've ended up marrying someone that's like my dad in that way, because my dad would never just pay full asking price. He's always asking for discounts and haggling. I remember I wanted a bomber jacket when I was 11. I was desperate for this bomber jacket. And he took me into the store and they said it was like, I don't know, £80 or something. And my dad was like, I'll give you 40. Like, we were in some like Moroccan market haggling. I was so ashamed. Anyway, needless to say, my dad got the jacket at the price he wanted to pay for it. And that was a lesson well learned.
I tell you what, they say that everyone can be bartered down on everything.
Apparently so.
But like you, I would just cringe. I don't know why. I'd almost want to pay them more as an apology. Why is that? There's something in us.
I guess everyone's different in their personality, but my dad has worked so hard for every single penny. And I think that he just appreciates it, because I've never not had anything. And obviously I'm appreciative of money, and I know that I'm super lucky and very fortunate and privileged, but not in the sense that I sold cakes and pens on a playground in school. And I think that does actually play a huge role.
In the Pink is sponsored by Bose, who've been perfecting the art of sound so that you can listen in unrivaled comfort. The new Bose Noise Cancelling 700s take it to a whole other level, so you'll always hear exactly what you want, no matter where you are. Also, be heard like never before with their unrivaled 4-microphone system, which isolates your voice whilst cancelling the noise around you. Pretty cool, huh? Always stay connected with Bose's first of its kind augmented reality function that will change the way you think about travel, exercise and learning. And never be caught out, because they have an excellent 20 hours of battery life. They come in black and silver, so you can work them around your style, your little fashionistas. And you can treat your ears with the Bose Noise Cancelling 700s. It's a sound experience like no other. Now, back to the interview. Right, now time for the biggest brain in Formula One. It's me. No, only joking. Adrian Newey. And what a pleasure he was to talk to you on In the Pink. He's got so many stories from his time in Formula One. And he has, of course, designed, created some of the best cars we have ever seen in our great sport. So as you can imagine, I loved catching up with him. I couldn't help but notice something in your downstairs loo that was your school report.
Oh, yes.
Which made for great reading, that described you as with the potential to do well when sensible, but can be extremely silly, and this must stop immediately. I mean, that really tickled me. Explain yourself, please.
Yes, no, I'm afraid I was always in trouble at school. I just, school and me didn't really go together. I think most of the lessons I found pretty boring, and kind of, to be perfectly honest, French in particular was I treated as a art class for sketching racing cars. That's all I ever did. I don't think I hardly learned a word of French and got unclassified in my O levels, so that didn't go too well. But I don't know. I wasn't deliberately mischievous, but I always seemed to end up in trouble.
So what? Okay, so not being challenged in the right direction, do you think?
I just found it kind of quite restrictive. When I got to college and then university, that was completely different. So I think that extra bit of freedom, but I went through the private school system in terms of prep school and then public school up until the age of 16. And the public school in particular, which was boarding, I just didn't enjoy. I was never that good at sport. And it was, if you kind of wanted to be popular, you needed to be good at sport. So that kind of put me on a bit of a back foot. Maybe I was considered slightly awkward or geeky, I'm not sure. But just never really enjoyed it, and was actually then asked not to return after O-levels, having done a few things, which suited me fine, because I then went to the local technical college and kind of got into motorbikes and girls and all the things that you couldn't do when you're at a boys' public school. And
I'm sorry, you can't just skirt around this for doing a few things. What did you do specifically to get expelled?
It was kind of...
science lab or anything?
No, not that one. But there are a few things. One was I was into karting at the time, go-karting. And so workshop manager was actually very good. There was a sort of workshop for, I don't know, woodworking and metalworking and so forth at the school. So I managed to persuade him to let me bring my kart back and tinker with it during evenings, and got it going. And then kind of ran it around outside the workshop, which is also by the school chapel. And of course, it made a hell of a racket. And one of the friends who had helped me with it said, could he have a go? He had a go and had a small accident in it, by which time the headmaster had turned up to see what all the commotion and the racket was about. So I was in a bit of trouble for that one, not asking if I could run it, etc. Caught in pubs, the usual stuff. And then the one, I guess, that was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back was the sixth formers had this thing where they could have organise an end-of-term pop concert. And that particular year, they managed to get a band called Greenslade, which was kind of like Tangerine Dream. It was one of those sort of 70s atmospheric bands. Anyway, it was also in the days of Oxford Loons and bags and so forth. So we managed to get hold of some half bottles of vodka and gin and so, and taped them to our shins underneath the trousers and smuggled them in, and then mixed them with Coke once you're in. I'm not sure why we didn't just mix it with the Coke before we went in. It'd have been a lot easier anyway. And kind of yours truly got fairly, well, ratted, let's say. The band itself had this a sort of sound mixing booth in the middle of the auditorium. So when the guy who was doing the mixing went off, I guess, to go to the loo, I jumped to the controls, slid all the sliders to max, at which point, again, the headmaster turned up, by which time I think I'd probably more or less passed out. Anyway, I was caught at the controls of the flipping sliders, taken off up to the school sanatorium, and given a stomach pump, which I think was a bit unnecessary. It's very unpleasant, that's for sure. And then the following day, apparently they found that all the sort of leading on the stained glass windows of this Piers building, which is, I think, built in the 15th century or something and survived Cromwell and everything. They're very proud of their original stained glass window. But anyway, some of the leading was cracked. And they decided that was my fault because of the noise. So I was my parents were summoned to take me away, which is actually also quite funny because my mother was, she was very much a leftover from the swinging 60s. She sort of always liked dressing in white with a miniskirt. And so she turned up and gave, with a potted plant, because the headmaster, she knew, liked potted plants. So she gave him this bright white, or beautiful white lily, and said, here you are, Mr. Gammon, wasn't it? Here's a small present for you. Now, about what Adrian, he's a good little boy, isn't he? And the headmaster said, no, I'm afraid he's actually been a very bad boy. She said, oh, well, so what happens now then? Well, I'm afraid you'll have to take him away. And she said, oh, well, if that's your attitude, Adrian, come on, let's go, and I'll have my potted plant back. That was it.
And I know you're not supposed to have favourites, but have you had one over the years of all the drivers you've worked with? Have you had one that you've particularly clicked with?
I think click is exactly the right word. So, you know, particularly when I was race engineering, there's some drivers... I think if you get it right, a race engineer-driver relationship can become very close. You kind of almost understand each other and you trust each other. And the driver gives the feedback that the race engineer needs, and then the driver trusts the race engineer to get on with it. And I had that probably with Bobby Rahal in particular in the States, Mario Andretti as well. Actually, it's those two that probably stand out most of all. Damon Hill and Mika Häkkinen as well. Now I'm kind of not quite as involved in the race engineering as I used to be. But in terms of kind of the drivers I do work with still and kind of...
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Emphasize with, I suppose, have friendships with. Then probably it'd be Mark and Daniel that I know best. Sebastian gets a hard time in the English press, and it's unfair because he's actually a really good person.
I think he's quite guarded, he's quite private, which is great for him, but yeah. Sometimes people don't see the real Sebastian Vettel, and actually it's quite endearing when you get to know him.
No, he's a great person. He's a great chap, and he's, you know, if the drivers now that have left the team but still come up and chat, and Sebastian is the one that's always popping around, which is nice.
And what about Pierre Gasly? Because obviously he got a pretty late, unexpected call up in some ways to join the senior team. It hasn't been the easiest start to the season for him. Has he got what it takes? Can he cut it at the top level?
I think he's had an unfortunate start because in Barcelona he had two big accidents, one in the first week of testing and one in the second week. And the second one in particular really put us on our back foot because it actually pretty much cost Max his last day of testing as well because we just didn't have enough parts to properly rebuild the car. So that kind of, it hurt our preparations for the season a little bit. But then I think psychologically for him, of course, it's quite a blow because now he's probably driving just a little bit stiff. Because he knows that if he crashes again, it's going to be really unpopular. In the race, actually, on Sunday, if you look at his pace, once he was in clear air, then it was very close to Max's. It's just he hasn't got his qualifying sorted yet. Mm-hmm. So, and the car wasn't easy to drive in Bahrain. It was quite badly affected by the wind. Melbourne, the qualifying is obviously just a mess. So I think it's don't judge let yet. Let it all settle down a bit and see. I think he'll get there.
Because it is quite hard for a driver to get into a new car and adapt to that car. I mean, the same can be said for Daniel in the Renault to an extent. It's a very different beast to the Red Bull. So it's a question of a driver adapting, and they should be allowed a bit of time to bed in, shouldn't they?
Yeah, so what you do get is some cars suiting a driver's style better than others. Mm. Sebastian, for instance, always, his driving style required a very strong rear end on corner entry. And if the car had that, then he was devastatingly quick. If it didn't, then he actually struggled. He didn't seem to be able to adapt his style that well to a car that didn't have that characteristic. Mm. I have worked with Kimi, sorry, but quite some time ago, but you hear Kimi always wanting a strong front end, which is actually, when I think about it, that's correct. So some drivers do have a style that they've developed, which if the car can't deliver that, they struggle with.
And is that how you separate the good from the great? Because everybody always still says that Fernando, I know he's obviously left the grid now, but Fernando was the greatest last year because he was able to get so much out of an underperforming McLaren, and that's the sign of a truly great driver.
Yeah, I think that is true. I think you saw that with Fernando, you saw it with Ayrton. Max is also able to do that. I think it's an extra string that if you can adapt your driving totally, and if you pick up whatever is required, that the car requires you to do, then that is amazing. And you see it with other sportsmen. I mean, Valentino Rossi, when Marquez came in with his unique style, then Rossi stood back, looked at it, thought, yeah, this is a new style, I've got to adopt it, and he has.
Right, next up on the Formula One Best Bits of the In The Pink podcast, it's Claire Williams. Now, Claire is in a unique position because she's come through the ranks of her eponymous team, and she's done it all on merit, which I know some of you are like, yeah, of course she has. But it's true. She's really earned her way to leading the team forward. It hasn't been easy. It isn't easy at the moment, but she has got a steely determination and passion for this sport. And that's almost palpable in this podcast. I love talking to her. Over to you, Claire.
Your sense of responsibility and commitment to Williams certainly runs deeper than anyone else's in the paddock. Because you do have this legacy and to uphold, and as you say, you've grown up with the team. When does the legacy feel inspiring, and when does it feel like a real weight on your shoulders?
Yeah, it's funny. Someone said to me the other day, and I've never had it put to me like this, that people could question my commitment to Williams because I've been, in inverted commas, born with a silver spoon in my mouth, and therefore am I as hungry as, say, somebody that hasn't had that? And the comparison was to my dad. You know, my dad came from very humble beginnings, very difficult beginnings. They didn't have any money whatsoever. My grandmother was a single mom, raised him, knew that a good education was what would get him out and, you know, give him a good platform moving into the big wide world. And, you know, so that there was that comparison, and I was kind of like, I don't think it necessarily works like that. I think it can be that's quite stereotypical to say, well, just because I was born into privilege. I recognise the privilege that I was born into, and that detracts in no way from how I feel about Williams and how committed I am to this team. This team is my life. You know, I grew up, as much as we weren't brought to races because, you know, Dad didn't take us because no one else has to take their kids to the office, and I respect that. But we were around Williams all day long, in the sense that when my dad came home from work at the dinner table, when we would all have supper together, that's what we talked about. You know, we went on family holidays. Not that Dad was ever there, but that was all we talked about. So it's so entrenched in me. Mm. I care about this so much because that's what we all cared about. That's what we were all taught to care about as kids, was Williams. And, you know, the team has always fought to survive in our sport for whatever reason, whether that be financially or competitively. So I'm very used to that, and I'm very conscious of the need to always, I suppose it's just inherent to me, the need to always make sure Williams is successful. So I have an enormous commitment to this team. I can't see my life without it. You know, I don't know really who I am without William. Someone, you know, and I was having a conversation with my husband and said, you know, he asked me, what would you do if it all went under or you sold it or whatever? And I said, I have no idea. And he said, well, you could go off and you could be a non-exec director for some companies or you could do speaking engagements. So it's like, but that's not me. You know, I am, Formula One is just so my world that I can't imagine my life without it.
In some ways, does that make it tricky to be objective and to say, actually, now might be the right time to sell or might be the right time to step down? Have you ever considered that?
You know, I got trashed for this last year, but when in the Netflix show, unfortunately, what I said was taken somewhat out of context. They didn't put the context wrapped, or they didn't wrap the context around. And, you know, I questioned my position within the team. But only so much as I'm not arrogant enough to sit there and think they can't do this without me and I have to always be here. Mm. Of course, when things are going badly, anyone should question themselves. It's the right thing to do. So, of course, I went through that process. But I haven't been brought up to give up. I don't give up. I fight harder when people tell me that I can't do things. And, you know, people are very judgy. I've found that in the past 18 months. But they don't know what we're going through. They don't know what I do necessarily. They don't know how hard I fight and I work. And I don't believe that my time to go is now. I don't believe that selling Williams now is the right thing to go. You know, this is sport. Sports teams go through difficult times. And it's what you do in these difficult times. It's the true test of who you are, whether that be as an individual or be as a team, as a sports team. Now is not the right time to pack up and go, we're done, we don't like it, we're not doing very well. It's about fighting, and it's about all working, us all pulling together and showing the world that we can do this and that we belong in Formula One, and our place in Formula One is at the top of the grid, not at the back of the grid.
They would never find anyone that cared more, that's for sure, if you did leave. And equally, as you've touched on, I doubt you'd find somewhere that you'd be as passionate about. And it's a difficult place to move from here because you've got to live and breathe it. I mean, as you say, it is part of your DNA. Just explain to us how that worked and how it became part of you over a number of years through your childhood. Just describe your childhood to us.
I had a wonderful childhood. I was very lucky in that I was brought up in the world of Formula One. You know, I got to go to Williams on weekends when Mum wanted a bit of a break from us kids. Dad used to have to pack us off with him on a Saturday, and we got to run around Williams. And I never remember really seeing my dad on those days. You know, I was plonked on a secretary's lap or something, and I used to help type letters and frank the mail. Franking the mail was a big thing of mine, but also raiding the stationery cupboard, filling my little backpack with Williams stationery. I still love our stationery cupboard. It obviously holds happy memories for me. You know, we used to zip line across in the race bays to have the big things that come down to lift the car from place to place, and Jonathan and I used to grab those and zip across the ceiling. It was brilliant, and coming to races was just great as well. But you know, as much as that, we were kids and we did lots of other stuff as well. And, you know, I was very lucky, you know, in that sense, being a part of that kind of life and knowing that my dad was incredibly successful. But, you know, obviously I went to boarding school. So in my late teens or mid-teens, I suppose, I wasn't around it a huge amount. I would always scour the... wasn't allowed to watch it. I would always have to scour the Monday morning papers to see how Williams did when it was a race weekend. But I never, you know, certainly we were never brought up by my parents to think that any of us would ever inherit Williams one day, that either any of us would ever run it. And when, you know, the time came to make our career choices, you know, going to university, I never had it in my head that I wanted a career in motorsport. It just kind of happened. It's kind of, my whole career has happened quite organically. I've never had a clear ambition to one day run the team. It's just progressively happened over the course of, you know, the 17 years that I've worked for Williams.
Wow, 17 years. Do you know something that struck me when I first met you was the fact that you called your dad Frank. And for a while I was like, that is Frank's daughter, isn't it? And I remember thinking, what a cool thing it was. A very simple thing, a very simple technique, but it brought respect, and it made other people, I think, realise that you know, you weren't daddy's little girl. Yeah. It wasn't pure nepotism. You'd earn your place. Was that a conscious decision? It must have been, obviously. You didn't call him Frank at home.
No, because I call him, I spend so much time in the office with Dad. I sometimes do make the mistake of calling him Frank, you know, a private time or, at, you know, family gatherings, whatever. And everyone was like, Claire, he's your dad, please, at least call him, you know, Dad occasionally. It was a very conscious decision I made very early on in my career at Williams when I first started. It was like, I'm not going to call him Dad in the office. It's, you know, I'm here and I want to do a good job and I don't want people, you know, thinking about the nepotism thing. And if you keep calling your dad in the office, they are going to think like that. You know, but the nepotism thing was quite a big deal, I suppose, in the beginning. And you know, it still is now to a degree in a number of ways. But Dad never wanted me to work at Williams. You know, it was our head of marketing that offered me the job originally, and he hadn't even asked Dad. And it took him about 3 months to persuade Frank to give me a job. And then Frank really thrashed me for the first 6 months. You know, really wasn't, you know, he really put me through my paces, putting me on a really long probation period and stuff like that. But because I hadn't been around the paddock a lot when I first started coming to races, and I wasn't allowed to come to races for a couple of years into the job. Sylvia Hoffer, who was our press officer at the time, who I effectively worked for trackside, had to go around. She introduced me to people as, you know, Claire, and people didn't know. A lot of people in the paddock didn't know for a long time that I was Frank's daughter. And Frank never treated me as his daughter when I would have to be there holding the dictaphone for interviews that he did and stuff like that. And that was great for me.
Along with Bose, In the Pink is sponsored by Tag Heuer, Swiss avant-garde since 1860. Excellence, precision and elegance. Their timepieces are designed for those who love challenges, which is a great fit for this podcast because most of the guests share that sentiment. Next up, a man who isn't currently on the front line in Formula One, but has been for many, many years. And he has got a brilliant insight to this sport. He's also a very bright guy, but very personable and has been there and done it at a very young age when you consider all he's achieved. I'm talking about Rob Smedley. And he gave us a very interesting take on what it's like to be an engineer in Formula One. Here he is, Rob.
How important is your relationship with your driver? Because I heard you say once you almost became too close to Felipe, and when he had his accident in 2009, it was very tough for you, and you said, well, actually, I don't want to get that close to a driver again. But how important is it to have that synergy and that strong dynamic in order to deliver performance?
I think it's important to have a really strong relationship with all of your, well, with all team members, first of all. You know, it doesn't have to be sat in, you don't want to be sat in an ivory tower. But definitely the drivers play a key role. And I think that I've always had with all of the drivers that I've ever worked with, I've always had a good relationship. You know, whether that's from a, you know, running a department point of view or a race engineer or a data engineer before that, a performance engineer. I think I've always had a strong relationship with the drivers because they are at some times probably the most fragile link. They can be the strongest link in the chain. They can be the most fragile link in the chain at times, and you've got to understand that actually, you know, as much as we as engineers, you know, we get a little bit of the limelight and let's say, you know, the responsibility for the car performance, it's them who go out on a Sunday afternoon, on a Saturday and Sunday afternoon. It's very easy that, you know, you'll very rarely, you know, look on, I haven't got social media, but you'll very rarely look on social media or the media in general, and you'll see, you know, individual engineers getting slated. But you will very, very often see individual drivers getting slated, and they're human beings, you know. As you know, from the strongest, from the mentally strongest of them, you know, like Fernando Alonso, to the less strong of them, they all have their foibles, and they all need an arm around them. And sometimes, you know, it's just about doing that, or it's also about, you know, trying to understand their technical language as well. That's the other reason why you've got to, you know, have a good relationship with the drivers, because they don't speak the language of engineers. They have, you know, that some of them, most of them are, you know, quite technically strong, but you've got to, they speak a different language, and you've got to understand that language.
Well, it's more about feel for them than it's about actual knowledge of
the technicality?
Yeah, they do. They feel, you know, all of them, they drive the car through their arse, you know. They feel it through their fingertips, and they feel it through the seat of their overalls. And you've then got to have some kind of, you know, it's like the Tower of Babel sometimes, where they're saying, you know, I often listen, especially with younger, you know, race engineers or whatever, is that they're saying something, and, you know, the race engineer will be having a completely different conversation with them, and you kind of have to get in there as a translator and say, well, actually, what he's actually saying is this, you know, and kind of put that translation together. Others are very good at technically explaining stuff, but as I say, they do speak a different language, but they do it from feeling. You know, they don't understand things at the depth of what engineers do, and nor should they, you know, because neither you could put an engineer in a car and get him to drive it at the speeds that the drivers do. So you've got to have that marriage between the two.
It's interesting what you say about the vulnerability of drivers, both in terms of social media criticism, they are exposed, but also physically on the track. And as you saw from Felipe's accident, you know, he's the one that took the hit, you know, literally, and risked his life to that extent. And I think that must be hard in a way for you, because you're something of a puppeteer, you're pulling the strings, but once they're out in the cockpit, they're kind of alone to that extent, aren't they?
Yeah, they are, and that's why I think they rely so much on their race engineers. You know, they become their lifeline, if you like, that you have got some link back to planet Earth while they're driving these machines. But I think that's why you've got to have that strong bond between the race engineer and the driver. It can't just be a professional thing where, you know, it's all kind of robotic and very professional and very clean. You've got to be able to have somewhat of a personal relationship, because when they're driving the cars at these very high speeds and they get themselves into a panic, or otherwise they just, you know, they just want some link back to planet Earth, back to the pit wall, then they need somebody. They need somebody human that they can rely on.
And that link brings me on nicely to your radio messages, which have become ringtones through the years. I mean, that is... I think it's probably because... Well, I don't know. Listen, I'm not singling anyone out, but at the moment, when you hear an engineer over the radio and they've just won a race, you kind of want them to go, "Yes! Come on, you bastard!" And sometimes they go, "Very well driven, congratulations." Yeah. And you go, "Come on, where's the emotion, where's the energy?" And we definitely saw a bit of emotion, a bit of personality in your radio messages, which kind of makes you stand out. Obviously, the most infamous one being in 2010... Do you have any regrets about the Fernando is faster than you moment in your career?
Yeah, of course I do, you know.
Why, what would you have done differently? What could you have done differently?
I think I probably, you know, if I look back on it, I think as a team, when I was like a pinball machine or something.
God, honestly, this was the quietest area in the whole restaurant when we arrived at 9 o'clock this morning, and now it's the loudest, so apologies for this. What I would say was ambient noise. It's not. It's just dominating. Anyway, back to 2010.
I think as a team, when we all look back, we probably could have done things differently. That's clear. But, you know, regardless of that, I think that what could I have done differently? I think you grow up, you know, and when I look back now, I can't even remember... What was it, 2010? It was 10 years ago, wasn't it? So I was like mid-30s, something like that. Definitely old enough to kind of know better. But whether or not you always behave like that in the moment is another question. I think that, you know, you kind of get yourself in a situation and feel aggrieved at things. And I definitely felt aggrieved that day that kind of, well, we've done the hard work and we're winning the race, you know, and you know, Fernando, if he is quicker, then he can pass us. So, you know, in that moment, you kind of get wrapped up in those thoughts. I think, you know, if I look back now, it was probably... I've never had a problem with team orders, by the way. I think team orders are part and parcel of the sport. They always have been, and they always will be. You got to deploy them at the right time. You can't just deploy them willy-nilly, but they've got to be done at the right time. And they kind of got to be done inclusively as well. You know, if you do them on an exclusive point of view where, you know, there's an inner circle that know about the team orders, but then nobody else does. I think that can create friction. So I think if you kind of, you're all sitting down and you're being honest with each other, you know, pre-season and pre-event, and you're saying, look, if this is the situation in this race, then there we will deploy team orders. I think most rational people wouldn't have a problem with that.
Whose decision was that then in 2010? Was it yours, or was it a group decision?
What, to deploy team orders? I mean, it's kind of, I guess it's a group decision in the end, but in the end, you know, Stefano would have made the ultimate decision that he wanted to deploy team orders.
So you have regret that you didn't stand up for that, against that decision? What is your regret?
No, the regret is that probably that you know, I made it quite obvious that we were deploying team orders.
You should have been more subtle.
I should have been more subtle.
Okay, so we're going to role play now. How can you be more subtle? I am Felipe. You are talking to me through Team Radio. Go.
God, I don't know, to be
honest.
Come
on, you've played this out in your head. You must have done.
No, I haven't.
You must have thought, I could have done that more discreetly.
Well, for example, after he got past, I said to him something like, oh, good lad, good on you, mate, for letting him pass, or something like that. Now just stick with him, or something like that. And I shouldn't have said that. You know, there's just, it's fairly subtle, to be honest, the changes that you would have made. But I should have... We all could have done better that day.
Right. Well swerved. No, but do you say that you shouldn't have said that to him afterwards because it was rubbing salt in the wound, that you were just pissing him off by saying that? Or you were accentuating, highlighting the fact that you had deployed team orders?
The latter.
Uh-huh, right, OK. And your regret was therefore that you got a big chunky 100 grand fine?
The regret was that. The regret was that, you know, in the end, I wished, you know, if I could go back in time, I'd want it to play out that we all kind of sat down pre-race and we said, right, this is what we're going to do. And Rob, you're going to have to do this at some point in the race, and Felipe, you're going to have to pull over if this is the situation.
Have a code that no one else can decipher.
Yeah, and it just kind of takes the sting out of it, the emotion out of it. But then, you know, the way that it then played out, you know, Felipe wasn't playing ball, was he? I think I told him 7 times or something like that. Bless him. And, you know, in the end, you know, poor Stefano was absolutely pulling his hair out, because what should have been just an easy, you know, me telling him once and him pulling over, didn't happen.
Yeah, but I mean, you can sit there before the race and agree something in principle, but in the heat of the race and drivers being drivers, they're not necessarily going to be compliant.
No, I think that if you have conversations, I think if you have adult conversations pre-race, pre-season, you know, we always try and do it pre-season now as well. And set out rules of engagement. I think if you do that, then it takes the emotion out of it so much more. Okay. I think if you're... And people are allowed to voice their opinion as well. If we say, right, you know, driver A is our number one driver, regardless of what it says in contracts, driver A is our number one driver, and driver B is, you are our number two driver. And, you know, it's not so much about number one or number two, but we will back driver A in the situation where there's a 50-50. You know, I think Ferrari have done, you know, for all Ferrari gets slated, I think, you know, what Mattia did at the start of the season by saying, right, well, we're going to back Sebastian when there's a 50-50 situation. I think that's absolutely fair enough.
And Charles will take that, given that he's new to the role and he's learning, and this, you know, you'd rather be driving for Ferrari than at the back of the grid.
Of course you would. Yeah. Of course you would. And Charles will definitely take that. But I think you're dead right in kind of setting that out. And what you do is you take all the emotion out of it. It's not just something that appears on a Sunday afternoon and people go, well, where did that come from? You know, there was a narrative leading up to that.
OK, another bit from the biggest smile in the Formula One paddock, Daniel Ricciardo, this time from the second podcast he did with us on In the Pink. OK, listen, to make this a good news day, because we want it to be... We want you to go off to your holidays back with your family in Australia with a spring in your step. Let's just reflect on Monaco for a couple of minutes to round off the podcast. Just how special was that? Because not only did you win the one that you've always wanted to win, but you did it under really difficult circumstances.
Yeah, I like this. We're ending on a good one. So Monaco was... I mean, it was the greatest... moment achievement of my career to date, for sure. More enhanced by probably the reception I got when I got back from the podium and all that, back to the team, the energy station, you know, as they call it at Red Bull. I'd never seen just a sea of people so, I really believe, like, so happy and excited for someone, you know. And it was like, I really felt at that moment that how I go about it meant a lot to a lot of people, and that just made me proud, I guess. So that was certainly the proudest moment in my career.
It was literally like you'd won the world championship, wasn't it, in that moment?
It was yeah, like there's no other way of putting it. It was huge. Like I felt like I'd done more than I'd actually done, was, you know, than just winning a race. There was certainly something else behind it. And it was huge. And I think as well, part of it was, you know, 2 years ago, my name won't be on the winner's board, but, you know, 99% of people believe that, you know, that was my race, and rightly so. So I think they'd carried a bit of that heartbreak with them for the last, you know, 24 months. To do that and kind of get the monkey off the back, and with a race where we had problems, I think it was just a massive relief for everyone. And, you know, I think their fear as well was that if my car did break down in that race, I probably would have walked away and just never come back. So just a massive relief for everyone. I mean, let's say losing Monaco twice would have been, the death of many of us.
Too much to bear.
Okay, next up on In the Pink Best Bits is Alejandro Agag. He is a visionary, the man behind Formula E. He's had loads of experience in Formula One, and he gave me his take on all things racing. Here he is, the Spanish maestro.
So here we are in your rather plush offices here in Hammersmith, July 2019. And when we look back and consider where Formula E has come, I guess it's actually quite symbolic when you walk around these ever-expanding offices. It just shows how well Formula E is doing. Has the success of the series surprised you? Has it come sooner than you expected? What are your feelings?
Yeah, well, the offices were definitely not this plush when we started. They were probably the size of the kitchen that we have here now. I guess that's a good sign, but it has definitely surprised us, yes. And we are far, far, far beyond our best expectations. When we started, we really didn't know what to expect. And obviously many, many people, there was a big consensus that this wouldn't work and that Formula was going to be, you know, how to have a short life. And, you know, we were, of course, worried about that. When everybody tells you, oh, no, this is the wrong idea and so on, we were like, oops, maybe they're right. But, you know, luckily we decided to give it a try and we thought we were right. And, yeah, we were maybe lucky, or also the times really changed in our favor. The whole kind of environment around us changed in our favor, and we probably were in the right place at the right time. So, yeah, it's a question where luck played a big role, obviously, and timing, which is always very important. And then we got kind of this momentum, and then the thing started growing and growing and growing, and now, yeah, and now we still keep growing a lot. I mean, we have the last race of season 5 in 1 week in New York, and I mean, the number of meetings of companies and potential teams, I mean, we cannot have more teams because we're full now, but a number of people want to get involved in one way or the other is huge. I mean, it's difficult to find space for all these meetings. So yeah, I guess it's a good sign. We, you know, touch wood.
So when you say we, are we talking you and Jean Todt? How did it start? Was it your brainchild or his? I hear a little story about a Parisian dinner.
Yeah. It was probably both. I mean, he came out.
It's never both. It's one person. Someone took the idea to somebody else.
So he asked me to have dinner with this other guy, who was a former. I used to be in politics many, many years ago. So when I was in politics, I was sitting next to this, in parliament, we were sitting next to each other. I was sitting next to this Italian politician. His name is Antonio Tajani. And this guy was, at the time when Jean Todt got elected president of the FIA, he was the commissioner for industry of the European Commission. And within industry, within his portfolio, he had the motor industry, the car industry. So Jean said, you know Antonio? I said, yeah, I know him very well. Oh, it'd be interesting to meet with him just to have a chat. And I said, well, I'll set up a dinner in Paris. So I spoke to Antonio, and he said, yeah, cool, I'd love to meet Jean Todt. let's have dinner. So the three of us had dinner in this small restaurant in Paris, in Estressa. And we started just talking in general about where the industry was going and what was Antonio's opinion and so on. And Antonio kept saying electric, 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 and all these new rules are going to be, you know, implemented about lowering CO2 emissions, and the industry is really going to have to go electric. Is very important. And Jean said the FIA should have an electric car championship. And then I said, yeah, and I would want to do it. I'd like to be the promoter of that. So if we have to give the credit to someone to have the idea, it would be Jean, because he's the first one who said we should have an electric car championship. Then a few months went by, and FIA did a tender, and I came up with a project. And I think the key for us to get and then we were a group, I had an investor with me and so on, but the key for us to get the license from the FIA was that we proposed a real racing product that could be feasible. And I think no one else really of the other bidders was coming from the racing world, and they didn't really know. They were saying, we would like to create an electric car championship, but they didn't know how to do it. We knew how to do it. Mm-hmm. We thought we knew how to do it. Then it was very difficult to do it, but we at least we knew where to get chassis from, where to get batteries from, how to organize the races. And so we could get also a lot of talent from, you know, because we were coming from the world of motor racing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was in GP2 and doing a lot of stuff with Formula One in sponsorship and television and so on. We knew. So FIA at the end gave us the contract.
And why were you personally so excited by this? Was it because you were anticipating the revolution in electric cars? You wanted to be part of this huge process, which none of us could have anticipated how big, I guess. But did you have the foresight at that stage?
What I did see was that we were in trouble in Formula One. So my world of my business was in Formula One, around Formula One. I didn't own a Formula One team, but I was doing a lot of business with sponsors around Formula One. I did business with television rights in Formula One, and I did also business with... I had my own team in GP2 that was bringing drivers to Formula One. So my main source of income was around Formula One. And I started to see that if Formula One didn't become green, it would be in trouble in the future, because the world is going in one direction and you're going on a different direction, and that never works. You have to be on the same direction where things are going, and even better if you get yourself ahead of where things are going. And I saw about 10 years ago that the whole world was going to become a lot more concerned about the environment, because the problem is becoming bigger and bigger and people are actually being more and more aware. So I thought we should create a green Formula One. That is, or at least we should make Formula One green, or if we cannot, and sadly, it's really difficult to change things quickly in Formula One, we have to create a new one. And that's where the big opportunity for the business is going to be. I mean, I would love to say I did this because I am to the core environmentalist, but I am an environmentalist, but I didn't do it for that. I did it because I thought it was the best way to position a business for the future. And yeah, it kind of happened. So, yeah.
And was it ever considered a possibility where it could be a support series for Formula One? I mean, why don't we do this on the same weekend or at least a week before, like some sort of...
You know, when this was born, Bernie was at Formula One. And probably that was the luck for me, because Bernie didn't really think that this was a strong enough option. I remember he called it milk float competition at the time. Without any, Bernie, I have greatest admiration, and we are friends for 20 years. But, you know, he just didn't believe in this. So we could create something separate. And I think it makes sense to keep it separate for a while and make it grow. And because we would not be able to grow if we were a support racer of Formula One. Formula One would always be kind of like controlling us. And having said that, I think in the future there could be space for cooperation, but more on... I'm not going to say on an equal level, but, you know, more on a way that we will, I don't know, make a kind of plan of our architecture for the whole future of the sport. Because I think Formula One is going to go electric eventually, has to go electric. The only question is when, and we have this license with the FIA. I mean, it would be much better if we kind of build the whole architecture together. Having said that, again, we have different shareholders, different owners, and they have different agendas, so...
You have the same parent company there, don't you?
Yeah, we have, but the same person, actually, not even a parent company, but the same person on top is Joe Malone, is a shareholder of all my shareholders, and also the shareholder of the Formula One shareholder. But that doesn't mean he directs the companies below. They are independent. They're listed independently. They are actually supposed to act completely independently and for the best interest of their shareholders, which are many, many thousands of shareholders because they're public companies. So they act independently. And yeah, and for the moment, the guideline or the direction that we have is to just be independent. Mm-hmm. Not to compete or not compete, because I don't think Formula E is a competition to Formula One, but to go on our separate ways.
Okay, next up is a bright star for the future of female racing. She's the W Series champion, and we're pinning our hopes on her to be a consistent female presence in the paddock going forward. I'm talking, of course, about Jamie Chadwick. Here she is, her best bits from In The Pink podcast. So just reflect for us, if you will, on when you got asked to be part of the Williams setup and the huge honour that must have been.
Yeah, so it's all kind of happened quite quickly. I mean, I've known Claire sort of on and off for a long time. I've sort of always updated her with what I've been up to, but there'd never really been an opportunity for me at Williams. But she had always sort of kept an eye on what I was doing. And yeah, when I first decided to do the W Series, I don't think she was fully on board with the idea of it. So she came out to Hockenheim with her husband Mark. Mark and I had conversations prior to the weekend. And yeah, after the first race, it was kind of agreed that we'd look at doing something, and yeah, a development role, academy driver style role would be available to me if I wanted to do it. And of course, for me, that was just dream come true. So yeah, it all came about quite quickly after that, and yeah, ever since it's been amazing to actually make that first step with the team. Doing a lot of simulator work at the moment, but also to come to the race weekends like this, it's really, really cool.
It's such an honour when you consider the history of Williams. Claire is such a great champion of other women, isn't she? Like, she's all about the sisterhood.
Yeah, exactly. And honestly, I don't think I appreciated it nearly enough until I've actually joined the team. Honestly, as a role model goes, she's fantastic, and really, but what she's doing with the team now, I think, is the most impressive thing, because it's not easy for her. She's not being gifted anything on a plate. She's got to do the hard work, and for me to see that, and her to even mentor me as well, it's so cool. And alongside that, I think the first race I did was Silverstone, and it was Frank's 50th anniversary. And really, when you see the history of that team, to be a part of it is just such an honour.
Now, listen, I've got my back to our departure gate, so can you keep an eye on things? It's delayed at the moment, isn't it?
I don't think we're going anywhere anytime soon, sadly.
Just snuggling
a red wine.
Very nice. Now, let's talk about you and your career, and the trajectory that you're currently on is really exciting. And, you know, I've followed your career, and you've been guests on Sky Sports many times over the years, and we've always, you know, had our eye on you, that this fresh new talent, female talent, very exciting for everyone. But now it really feels like it's coming to a point where you're being able to show the world just what you've got and where you deserve to be. Is that how it feels to you?
Yeah, it does. I think the last 6 months especially, I don't know, for whatever reason, right time, right place, it just feels like it's accelerated 10 times. And yeah, it's those kind of, sort of trajectories, like you're saying, you can go along your whole career so just making little steps, and sometimes you know what you want to achieve, but it almost seems unrealistic because you're not making the steps you want to make. And really, I would say, yeah, in the last 6 months, that step has just been starting to happen, and suddenly you've got one hand on looking at something that was a dream could potentially be a reality. And yeah, I'm so happy with the way things have sort of panned out. Like I said, a lot of being in the right place at the right time, but yeah, it's great for me, and it's great for women in motorsport as well. I think the opportunities are just getting that much greater, and yeah, I feel like I'm in a good place right now with that.
Did you ever doubt that the W Series would give you that platform, or from the off did you know such a great calibre of people involved in it that you knew that this was something special?
Yeah, it's funny you should say that, because honestly, when it was first launched, I was a bit sceptical. Then I think we went to the first test and still a little bit sceptical. I was unsure as to how it would be received and what they were going to do with it. And it wasn't long after that. I think the test after that was the first assessment process, in Melk in Austria. And then I was like, no, this is going to be really cool, and this is going to be what I want to be involved with. And the standard of drivers and the standard of the people that were, you know, organising it, everyone behind the scenes. I think it obviously took a lot longer for it to be in the public eye and a lot of sceptics before that. But when it was actually launched, I think people realised that this is something that is going to be a game changer in motorsport. And I think the way they've done it's been really impressive. So, yeah, I've honestly got no doubts now. It's probably the best decision I've made in my career to get involved with it. And, yeah, it's fantastic for, well, I think for me, but also for the other 19 female racing drivers that are on the grid.
Do you feel you've improved as a driver? And if so, how?
I do, actually. I get asked this question a lot, and a lot of people ask me how tough it is. And the reason I say that is because I think, very typical racing driver, there's always an excuse, or there's always like an escape route in pretty much everything I've raced in. With the W Series, that's not there at all, because we're all sharing engineers, we switch cars each weekend, we share data, so there's no real kind of, oh, well, he or she's in a better car than me, or they've got a better team, they've done X, Y, Z. That's all eradicated. So for me to gain an advantage and be my best on that day, I almost have to better myself that much more, and it's quite a mentally intense environment. You're all together a lot of the time, and so from that side of things and dealing with the pressure, I feel like I've had to, yeah, definitely better myself.
And is your main competitor Alice Powell, is she kind of your toughest competition?
Yeah, so Alice has come on strong. She had a couple of really unfortunate weekends, a couple of DNFs, more or less not her own fault. But yeah, my moment going into the last race is between myself and a Dutch girl called Bijtske Visa. Bijtske, another girl, had some good opportunities when she was younger, but unfortunately just didn't have the opportunity to continue racing in single-seaters. So BMW contracted now, but yeah, it's come back into it and it's come back in very strong. So she's keeping me honest. But yeah, we've only got one race to go, so fingers crossed.
And that's at Brands Hatch, isn't it?
It is, yeah, home race, which is nice.
That's going to be awesome. And presumably you'll have a lot of media attention, and there should be, you know, quite a good atmosphere around there.
Yeah, honestly, I cannot wait. I think I also cannot wait, but I also just want to go and do the race, because that's the main bit that I want to focus on. But yeah, I think the W Series, they put on a great show, and they've invited a lot of people down. I've got a lot of family and friends coming down as well, so yeah, hopefully I haven't jinxed it, and fingers crossed we can do what we need to do.
Next up is my friend and fellow Formula One reporter and presenter Lee McKenzie. Lee had a fascinating childhood growing up in Formula One, and loved talking to her as always. Here she is with her best bits.
Your dad really was your big influence in motorsport, wasn't he? But yeah. So was it a sort of a foregone conclusion that you would work in Formula One as well?
I don't know if it was a foregone conclusion about Formula One, but my father was a Fleet Street journalist, and I was the annoying child that turned up at everything. So not to go to school, to brownies, to Sunday school. I had done Wimbledon's by the age of 12. I'd done Rugby World Cup when I was 11. I missed about 2 months of school to go to that.
Wow.
He only started doing Formula One because somebody took ill, and he went to do the Mexico Grand Prix in 1991, I think it was. And he just went to do that one, and I think he finished off doing them about 4 years ago. He went to Ayrton Senna's funeral. He wrote a book about Damon, a book about Nigel Mansell. So he was very much in it. The only way when a parent is traveling like that to see them is to actually go to events. And you're good. You bring your kids with you to different events as well. And that was a different world of Formula One when I was a kid going to events. So I would, you know, there weren't motorhomes as such. It was like one truck with an awning out the front and massive big barrels of free cigarettes everywhere. So I would just go filling my pocket with cigarettes.
You're
and
joking.
Things at the age of about like 13 and stuff, like West and all these different things. And you saw, you know, you could walk around, you could sit and go to dinners with David Coulthard. What an exciting person. How I'd love to meet him. Now essentially he's my boss and I can't get rid of him. Michael Schumacher, all these different people. I was the annoying child, as I say, that turned up everywhere. You know, I would wash the dishes at Stewart at Ford. And just because I was hanging around all the time, he only took me to quite dull places like Manicure and Silverstone, where you couldn't really get into any trouble. And then when I left school, went to university, whilst I was at university, I was working for FOM. Bernie gave me a job. My interview was, can you count from 10 to 0 backwards in 3 languages? And I was given the job of PA when FOM was doing World Feed, and it had different channels. It had like the Pits and Highlights channel. So that was basically my job interview. And essentially, I couldn't really do the job at all. And when I think back, I must have been a nightmare. But, you know, I was there in 98 when DC caused a massive pile up in Spa and things like that. So, I went into it that way. And then, cut a long story short, I've probably worked in just about every genre of motorsport, from Champ Car to DTM to F3000, IndyCar. You know, I was a co-driver in 3 rounds of the World Rally Championship, which I loved doing. And it's not just a job, it becomes your lifestyle. And people like Nico Hülkenberg and Sergio Perez, Valtteri Bottas, these guys all used to live, we all lived within 2 streets in Oxford. So we all knew each other. We would travel to the races together. I was doing PR for some drivers as well. So, you know, I have known them way before they got to Formula One. So, you know, I first knew Nico Hülkenberg when he was 17 in A1 GP. So you get these relationships with drivers. Yeah, so I did A1 as well.
With Georgie Thompson.
Yeah,
lovely
so
Georgie.
I did host and Georgie Thompson presented it for Sky.
That's
so
right.
That's still probably the best job I will ever have, which is probably why it doesn't exist anymore, because I think there was probably about as much partying as there was driving. Jos Verstappen drove for Team Netherlands, and that is when you feel ancient.
Wow.
When you've actually interviewed when the dad is driving, albeit he was pretty old and at the end of his career, and now you're interviewing his son. That never fits well.
Wow.
Okay, so looking forward to 2020. We are in 2020. Bloody hell, can't believe it. It's coming around pretty quickly. Testing will be here before we know it.
Weeks away.
I know, yeah. Who most excites you? Obviously, Max is now locked in.
Yeah.
Red Bull till 2023. Charles Leclerc has done the same with Ferrari, which is great, really. Kind of sets up the stall a bit, doesn't it? What do you think we can be most excited about this year, other than seeing each other at the paddock?
This year is a funny one because it is the last year before the big reg changes. Mm. So how much will actually change this year? Because surely everybody has got their 2021 heads on.
Mm.
It is a kind of lost year. I'm not trying to put anybody off, but I don't see why the norm would change in 2020, because I think that everybody is geared up for this massive set of rule changes, which is coming in 2021, where I think that, you know, Red Bull will be absolutely on it. And I'm really excited, though, to see how the Max and Charles battle goes, because they are the future of the sport. You know, will this be Sebastian's last year? It sounds, from, if you believe what you read in the newspapers and also from Ferrari, it sounds like it could be. So there is going to be a bit of a changing of the guard, but, you know, Seb and Charles have got to get through another season at Ferrari to get to that last race, possibly in Abu Dhabi, because that is going to be fireworks.
I don't know about you, but I saw a real shift in Charles in Austria when Max did the overtake. You kind of felt like he was like, okay, I can get my elbows out now as well. You know, I don't have to playing this Mr. Nice Guy so much anymore. And you saw him really step up. And I really feel for 2020 that we're going to build on that rivalry, which I think the fans will love.
Yeah, and that is the future.
Mm.
You know, that's what excites me most, that, you know, Formula One is quite a brutal sport in a way that you get, like, you know, you stand there at the end of a season and you're getting all emotional and you're interviewing Felipe Massa and Fernando Alonso, what is your biggest highlight, and you've brought so much to the sport, and, you know, you sort of have these conversations like the sport's not going to be able to continue with them. Without being disrespectful, you know, how many times were they really mentioned last year?
Mm.
Probably not that many, because it moves on. You know, if I left tomorrow, I'll never be mentioned ever again. If anyone mentions again.
It.
No, but it's true, though. I mean, the sport goes so quickly.
I'll miss you.
The sport goes so quickly.
Do you think we'll still be there with like Zimmer frames down the pit lane?
Absolutely.
Going,
but they'll be electric.
<'Cause they're
off. laughs> And they won't make a noise, so I'll definitely get run over in the pit lane. Yeah,
girls,
I just
give it up. Move on.
Exactly.
Make way for the younger models.
I think it's what excites me is some new races on the calendar as well. You know, there's going to be Vietnam at Zandvoort, which I know they're doing a lot of rebuilding at. Zandvoort's a track that I've been to many times, and it is fantastic, and Tarzan Corner and things. I hope they don't all change too much of it, but to be honest, to get Formula One there, you're going to have to do some considerable work to it. But, you know, I do think for anyone, I'm sadly not going to that race because I'm presenting rugby that weekend, but I do think for anyone going to that race, you probably don't want to book a flight back until about the Tuesday because the traffic and fans will be so intense. I mean, I missed flights back from, you know, the F3 Masters from there and things. And that's like an F3 weekend and it's fantastic. But, you know, you're not getting a flight back for a day.
The only place that we can end this collection of best bits is with Daniel Ricciardo and his singing. Take it away, boy.
Okay. Again, I apologise for viewers or listeners.
Well, no, some can view. There's a podcast. There's a GoPro. That's what I meant to say. Alrighty. So you just come in when you're ready. Okay.
We'll see how my musical timing is. Probably terrible. One, two, one, two, three. Heading down south to the land of the pine, thumbing my way into North Carolina, staring up the road and pray to God I see headlights.
Oh, he's gone up and up.
I made it down the coast and the voices throw me off. And I'm hoping for Riley, I can see my baby tonight.
So rock me, mama, like a wagon wheel. Rock me, mama, any way you feel. Hey, mama, rock me.
Rock me, mama, like the wind in the rain. Rock me, mama, like a southbound train.
Hey, mama, rock me.
I want to apologize to anyone listening.
Beautiful, just keep it going. Come on.
All right.
Feel it, baby, feel it.
I'm gonna take the headphones off again. I got this. Running from the cold up in New England, I was born to be a fiddler in an old town string band. My baby plays a guitar, I pick a banjo now. Oh, the North Country winners keep on getting me down. Lost my money playing poker, so I hacked it up late, but I ain't a turning back. Living that whole life no more.
So rock me, mama, like a wagon wheel. Rock me, mama, any way you feel. Hey, mama, rock me.
Yeah.
Rock me, mama, like the wind and the rain.
What you gonna do?
Rock me, mama, like a southbound train.
Okay.
Hey, mama, rock me.
Alrighty. Old Crow Medicine Show, shout out. They can probably stop now, right?
No, I want the next one.
Really?
Just so you see Roanoke.
Oh, it's good. Walking to the south, out of Roanoke, I caught a trucker out of Philly, had a nice long talk. He's a hit of west from the Colling Gap, a Johnson City, Tennessee, and I gotta get a move on.
Beautiful. Daniel Ricciardo, ladies and gentlemen.
A Johnson City.
He's still going.
Tennessee, and I gotta get a move on before the sun. I hear my baby calling my name in an order. She's the only one. If I die early, least I will die free.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
Okay, that's it for Best Bits of the Formula One in the Pink podcast. Thank you so much for your company. Don't forget, you can win those Bose 700 noise cancelling headphones. Just tell us which guests you've loved the most and why. Rate, review, subscribe. And you can win Premier League tickets courtesy of Tag Heuer. Do the same, but put hashtag PL at the end. Loads more great guests on the way very soon. But thank you for your company. And we'll speak again very soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders that we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like worried of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.